back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Today my guest is Anna Maria Manalo. First announcements. Our website is forbiddenknowledge.news. It's the home of the Forbidden Knowledge Network, where we feature some of your favorite podcasts. Forbidden Knowledge News is always available on Rockfin, Odyssey, Rumble, and all podcast platforms. Our social media is Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Rockfin is where you get our premium content. You also get all the premium content from every creator on Rockfin for only $10 a month. Just click the link in the description. All those links are right there in the description. Today I want to welcome back to the show Anna Maria Manalo. She is a therapist, screenwriter, and travel photographer, and creative nonfiction author of supernatural anthologies and suspense novels. She has amassed paranormal encounters from all over the globe as an artist and traveler. Her cinematic storytelling style and characters based on real individuals brings books that fully immerse the reader in the experience of the phenomena as she takes them into terrifying landscapes. Anna, welcome back. How you doing?
I'm pretty good. It's been a pleasure last time we were on. So, thank you for having me come back.
Hey, it's great to have you back on. Can't wait to get into this. We're going to be discussing your latest best-selling book, Unholy Structure, The Mansion That Refused to Be Restored. The book is a nonfiction work based on a case from John Curley, who is founder and lead investigator of Harrisburg Area Paranormal Society. Now, the names and locations had to have been changed, but the main idea of the stories have been left intact, and it is fantastic. Like I said, I can't wait to get into this. Before we do, remind the audience about yourself and what led you to write these types of books.
Well, that's a long story, Chris. I'll have to tell you that it began at the beginning when I was just a small child. For the audience who's new to me, I was born and raised approximately 50 minutes outside of Manila in a little town. At the time, it was really basically a village, and now it's a bustling suburb. My father was a writer himself, as I am. He was contributing to magazines and things of that nature, and he spent a lot of time at home. This all began one evening for him, and it's pretty terrifying. To this day, I don't know exactly what he saw because I was only about 2 years old when this all happened. But if you remember the film Mothman Prophecies, with Richard Gere.
Yeah.
My father started seeing something in let me just explain the setting. In 1960, my parents got married. I know this is probably before you were born, Chris. And they shortly moved into a townhouse. The townhouse, from what I understand, was newly built. And it backed into a creek, which had a whole bunch of trees that were kind of like over the creek. So the back of the apartment, and there were about, I think, 6 or 8 units, and they were somewhere in the middle of this townhouse, you know, first and second floor dwelling. The whole back had windows facing out onto the creek, with these huge old ancient trees. My father took the central bedroom because there were 3 bedrooms. One bedroom was theirs. My nursery was on the right-hand side of his office. And he pretty much would write all day long, or, you know, most of the day. And in the evening, he started seeing something that he couldn't quite define. And what that was resembled Mothman quite a bit. That's where my voyage began and my interest began with these kinds of supernatural events. And it went on, sad to say, several months later, my father committed suicide because he could no longer sleep. This creature had attached itself to him. It got to the point where he felt like it was going to devour his soul, if he went to sleep. So after several months of not sleeping, trying to do what he could to avoid it or protect himself from it, and my understanding is that there was some support from his parents, from his family. You have to remember, he was only in his early 20s at the time. But they were really at a loss to explain what that creature was, which came from a tree. His explanation to my mother was that whatever it was came out of the tree, and then it would attach itself to a window, his window. And just like the Mothman, it was very much like a silhouette, but you could see its features on its face. It had the eyes of a goat and the visage of what you traditionally would see in something like Jeepers Creepers.
Right.
So it was terrifying. So that started me writing things. And I actually did not escape that townhouse because after he passed away, we moved into my grandparents' house. And in that particular dwelling, they did not know. And this is a house that was built back in 1945. It was built on soil that apparently was kind of like an unofficial burial ground for Japanese soldiers. The area where the homes were built, where my grandparents' homes were built, apparently there was a massacre that took place there. There was a battle that took place there from World War II. And there were a lot of bodies that were later discovered when they were redoing the street. But apparently, it wasn't just the street, it was also underneath the homes. So it was kind of like a neighborhood that really shouldn't have been there to begin with. They never exhumed the bodies. People didn't know that that was a very active area as far as the war. So the hauntings continued. We moved there, whatever it was that was plaguing my dad. Followed us, according to my mother. So that's how I got started, Chris. And then, we're zipping now into my adult years, my early adult years. I really went into doing a lot of counseling work. I was a school counselor, actually, for about 26 years. Before that, I did research, and of all things, it was in depression because my father eventually became depressed because of the sighting. And then jumping into the year 2008, met up with friends, and one was involved with MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network. So I ended up becoming an investigator, and that's a funny story in itself. And I had an opportunity to really see a lot of cases, meet with a lot of people, interview a lot of people. Some had documentation. Some, actually filmed some footage of UFOs that were flying through the sky. To this day, I can't explain what they are. That set about kind of like an odyssey where I started documenting everything that came my way, including the ones where they didn't want MUFON to really, become involved. So I had like some maybe 60 odd cases that I riffed through. And then from that, I put together my first book, which is Portal.
After all the research and work you've done with not only paranormal happenings but ufology, what kind of do you believe that there is a profound connection there that most researchers aren't putting together?
I think that I'm not really sure how this began, but I think that one of the things I've noticed is that paranormal investigators are divided into two camps. And I think for the most part, that kind of like leads to people thinking when you're looking at ghosts and phantoms, things that are supernatural, it's really not part of a bigger paranormal event. I tend to think them all as being connected, the sightings of UFOs, of orbs, or, of abductions. I think that you're looking more at kind of like a huge realm of paranormal, of which they are all part of different segments of the unseen. So I know that, and I think I mentioned this to someone before in a previous podcast. When you talk about Bigfoot, and I don't have that much experience about Bigfoot, but when you talk about Bigfoot, there's been cases where people have only seen UFOs also. So there's kind of like a concurrent event that's happening that you never thought would be connected. But I think that these aliens, these ETs, these entities somehow are also part of a bigger picture of ghosts and phantoms and cryptids. They're all just that huge unknown that we might not understand to be, after all, connected in some way. So that's the only critique I have of the paranormal community. So it's like if you're, a person who looks at ghosts, it's exclusively that. And then if you're looking at abductions and UFOs, extraterrestrials, it's another segment. But somewhere in there, really, there's a gray zone where they overlap. But that's just my belief. I don't really have anything concrete other than I'm noticing that in some of these cases, there's a little bit of interplay.
Yes, and there seems to be a layer of reality that we can't perceive, an unseen type of realm where a lot of these life forms and energies and entities possibly reside around us at all time. We just can't perceive them unless either they want to be perceived or maybe we get on a certain frequency where we can actually see them for a minute, you know?
Yeah, Chris, you have a good point there because a lot of this, I think, hedges on whether these entities, whatever they are, assume that that we are receptive. If the recipient of the experience is open to experiencing, or at least receptive to experiencing or entertaining the thought of after death, life after death, or beings that live in another planet, another dimension, I think they're more likely perhaps to experience it if these creatures think that these people are ready to experience something like that. I think it's more likely to happen. On the other hand, I've seen stories as well of the other side where you've got people who are hardcore skeptics that don't believe in any of this stuff, and they kind of dismiss it as, oh, that's just your imagination, flights of fancy, or maybe even like an intentional, like a thought form. And then they themselves experience it. And immediately they can't, of course, explain what it is. And then they keep experiencing it. And eventually they become the people that would speak about it.
Right. Yes.
So
Well, we're living in
it's
very
interesting.
interesting times right now, and I think people are more open to discussing their experiences because of the stigma has been kind of lifted a bit with everything that's happened in the past few years, when it's especially when it comes to the talk about UFOs and the mainstream media and things. I think it may have opened some people's mind a little bit to these possibilities.
It certainly has. And I've noticed too that even with the supernatural paranormal field, there's just a plethora of TV shows that are out there now that talk about, hauntings and places that, that are remote, that haven't been explored, that people are now venturing into. The only critique I have to that is sometimes I think people take it too lightly, that they want to make it like it's an adventure or a source of entertainment, not realizing there's a lot of danger in these things. And when we're talking attachments, could it be, something where you bring home an object, an antique, as in my previous book, and not realize that there's something that's attached to the object? Or actually walking into a haunted house or a haunted hotel. These are not things people should take lightly because it takes a lot of energy, and there's certainly a lot of malaise, a lot of evil stuff that can happen to the person and even the person's family, if people don't take it seriously, what is actually happening in those places. Yeah, we've come a long way, I think. I think the media is a lot more realizing people are changing, that they're more receptive. Some people find it entertaining, and I think they're thinking, okay, if you find this entertaining, let me introduce this concept to you and see, how far we get with how much people can learn. So there's really a learning curve with these types of shows. But what's good about them is that, some of them tap into like real situations. So it's not just entertainment. I mean, it's kind of tough to try to sell someone a different concept of reality unless you put it in a format of something that really makes people think and absorbs them, and is more evocative.
Yeah,
I
it, we
think
are
we've
definitely in interesting times when it comes to exploration of consciousness and metaphysics and paranormal things. It does make me encourage that people are becoming more open-minded about that. Now, I want to get to your book, but first, I want to get your thoughts on something that you mentioned, that the entity that was terrorizing your father would come in his sleep. Was this causing some sort of sleep paralysis for him?
I don't know much about what was actually happening to him personally. I'm going by mostly storytelling from both my mother and my grandparents, and to some extent, a couple of uncles that were witnesses to what had occurred. The one that has the most information, and she's still relatively healthy today, was my mother. It still bothers her. I do know at some point he stopped sleeping, to answer your question. He was very, very afraid of what it might do to the rest of his family. He knew it was attached to him. For what reason, I don't know. I think to this day they were just really surprised because he's a pretty outgoing person. And I guess you have to be when you're a writer. You have to kind of like engage a lot of people. And he wasn't kind of like the type that would really be solitary, although because of it, he increasingly withdrew, stayed away from people. And they said that he rarely slept in the final few months because of the fact that he was afraid it would enter his mind. And I think it was someone had said this to me later on that it might have been a precursor to possession. I
Very
don't know.
interesting. Now, the reason I ask is I've done quite a few shows lately with researchers that look into sleep paralysis and shadow figures and these strange sleep entities that seem to have an effect on us whenever we're between waking and dreaming. And I've had the experiences myself, quite a few years ago, and at the time I didn't attribute anything paranormal to it. I thought it was just what, science tells us, it's sleep paralysis, and your brain makes these weird things happen. But looking back, I think there was a lot more to it. I was in a very bad place at the time, and the occurrences that were happening were pretty profound, and there were actually seemingly entities in the room with me, and I couldn't move to get up. But I want to get your thoughts on, have you done much research into sleep paralysis and the possibilities that this is something more than just a medical condition?
I don't think that it's a medical condition at all. I'm not really sure that there's anything physically wrong with a person. I could be dead wrong. I mean, I think it's case by case basis. I think what people are experiencing is that there is something invasive, there is something in the room, and somehow the presence is trying to get their attention. Whether it's because they want to study the person, they want to abduct them, or maybe perhaps it's even something evil that somehow has broken through a portal. Those are things that are more foremost in my mind when someone says sleep paralysis. No, I have not done much research, but what I do know from people I know who have had it, they're terrified. I mean, it's terror. They call it night terrors. And I have reason to believe it's not just something internal. Some people tell me, oh, it must be something you ate that didn't agree with you. This, and I don't know. That could be true, but I don't know. I really think it's more than just diet. I think it's more than just your own internal, anxiety. I mean, how many anxious people do we meet that have night terrors? I think it's more there's a third element entering the room or the person's psyche somehow that's actually begging to be noticed or coming in to do something to the person. I mean, I don't know what your experiences were, Chris, but I'm also curious now that we're on that topic.
Yeah, well, that during the time this was about, oh, it was over 10 years ago, and I was actually going through a divorce at the time, and it was just a bad, kind of heavy time in my life, and I wasn't sleeping well. But when I would get to sleep, I'd get into these paralyzed states where shadow figures would be walking around either in the next room or right next to me, and I couldn't move my head to see who was there. And then all of a sudden, loud banging noises would be coming from above me, and it would sound like somebody is hammering and like through my ceiling, and then it would just go louder and louder until I would force myself to kind of pop out of it. And it was pretty terrifying, and it lasted until I got into a better state of mind after my divorce.
So it went away eventually when
Yes.
things got better for you emotionally, it
Yes,
seems.
definitely.
And to me, that makes sense in the sense that I don't know that it's your internal anxiety or your own internal upheaval. I mean, I know you're going through that. I went through a divorce myself. But I think what's happening here, at least from what you've told me, is that people come into a part of their life, which is kind of like a dark void. You go down to the very depths of a negative state is what is happening. And because you're in a negative state, you tend to attract negative entities. So once again, to me, my interpretation leans more into the fact that when we're negative, we attract negative types
Yes,
of thing.
I definitely have to
So,
lean towards that as well.
yeah, and so our mood states pretty much send out vibes, send out the kind of energies that we really don't want, but it unwittingly attracts, especially if it's for a prolonged period of time. It does attract negative entities because we're negative, like attracts like. I was told in a different vein, when you start talking about demonic energy, you start talking about evil, malignant types of forces, because you're talking about it, your mood shifts, and then you're unwittingly inviting in those types of entities, not so much into the show, but maybe into the room you're in, the environment you're in. That kind of stuff. So I think with sleep paralysis, it's the same thing. Maybe you're going through turmoil, like in your case, at that time in your life. So it brings you down, and then forces come in that further bring you down into a spiral.
Yeah, I'd
If
have to
that
agree
makes
with that.
sense.
Yes, it does, and I'm just glad that I'm no longer in that mental state anymore where I have to deal with that. That was pretty terrifying. Well, let's talk about your book. What brought you to write this particular book? How did you find out about this location?
Okay, actually didn't find out about this location. It was the person that approached me. It's one of those things, once again, where it seems like I don't have to go too far. I actually got a message, of all places, on Facebook from a gentleman who was a paranormal investigator. He founded the Harrisburg Paranormal Area Society. It's a long name, but the short of it is HAPS, HAPS. They are located right past the Harrisburg area, where there's a lot of old homes. You've seen Gettysburg, just to name a few of the more common places, but there's also a lot of old inns and mansions and remote areas, not just in Pennsylvania, but in the neighboring areas. This particular house is actually a mansion. He mentioned it to me very briefly on Messenger, and he said that there were a lot of other cases as well that he would like me to write about. So at some point, I reached out to him and we had a conversation. The first case he shared with me was actually not about this case. It was more a haunting in a family that ended up dabbling with an Ouija board, which, you know, is a normal portal in a lot of cases to these type of infestations. Things are nice, quiet, everybody gets along. Then one day someone decides to bring home an Ouija board, which is kind of like bringing home a Dybbuk box. Or recently I was watching a remake of Hellraiser and they had this little puzzle box. So it's kind of like introducing something that's unknown into the house. And most of the time people think, oh, it's only a parlor game. You know, it's just a board and, you know, you've got all these numbers and letters and play with it. Well, that's what this family did. Because the case was still active, because there were a lot of things that was happening actually to the investigator himself. It's one of those cases where I had to think twice about whether I really wanted to write about it. And I'll tell you why, Chris. In the course of our conversation on the phone, and we'd had numerous conversations on the phone going through different cases, the one particular case I refused because as we were talking, the room I was in, the room I was physically sitting in, like the way I'm talking to you now, got darker, got quieter, and there was a perceptible coldness. The temperature in the room started to plummet. The longer we talked about the case and he was describing to me the entity that was infesting the house. So I had to sit there and think, do I really want to immerse myself for the next 3 or 4 months that it would take to write this book?
Wow.
In a case that seems to be so active that it's actually coming into the house I'm in.
Now, has that ever happened to you before? Have you ever experienced anything like that to where you're just discussing a possibility that you're going to write about and then all of a sudden it manifests?
I had a podcast, Chris, a few years ago. It was actually for Coast to Coast. And Coast to Coast, which is out in California, usually airs pretty late for us people who are here on the East Coast. So I was up at midnight to about 2 a.m., give or take. And I'm trying to remember whether I was in the first or second segment of the show. It probably might have been much later. Because it was the height of summer, I chose to sit outside on the deck. My deck faces a forest and a farm. So about 50 yards from me starts the tree line into the farm, and on one side there's a forest. We were talking about UFOs. We weren't talking about spirits or anything like that. But as I started the show, 10 minutes into it, I was answering a question about sightings. And right through the trees, I started seeing something that was lighted. And it wasn't a plane. It wasn't a helicopter. There was no noise whatsoever. It started as a dime, and then it started to become brighter and brighter. And it creeped me out, Chris. I picked up my laptop. And in the dark, I had a couple of lights to light the deck. I actually physically told them I had to go inside because there was something that I was seeing. And then I sat inside and through the window, I could see whatever it was, something very luminous. I continued the show, but it gave me an element of surprise that whatever it was I was talking about actually started manifesting in front of me. I still don't know what it was. Eventually, it effervesced, went away, but it was much larger than a moon by the time it was done.
Wow, that's pretty
And I was
terrifying.
describing it on this. So that's the first one. The second one was this conversation with John. So after about an hour of the conversation, I declined the case. And then it was maybe a couple of more weeks before he came up with this case, which you now see the book. This is a different one in the sense that it was already completed. They had already spent a lot of time. Like the other one, there wasn't closure to it per se. So unlike my other books, there is really no closed ending. It was more an open one. Because it really resisted every attempt of every person to record it or try to get it to leave whatever it was that was in. And it was more than one thing that was in there. It was you've read it with several different
Yes.
things.
And the mansion was built in 1750, right? And they had like 20 bedrooms and 8 full baths and 3 floors, right? Yeah, that's a massive house. Now, according to your research, last time it was really renovated was in 1945, right after World War II.
So there was a length of time that it was actually an inn. I think it began as a family house, and then eventually it was made into an inn. And that's when things started to unravel with people who were coming and going. Not to give away the book, but there was a gentleman in question who chose to stay at the inn. And there was a young woman who also happenstance also decided to stay at the inn. There were a lot of strange things that were happening to it as well. But it seemed to focus primarily on this one person who wreaked havoc on a number of people that were in the inn, either as employees or as tenants, passing by in a stagecoach and things of that nature. So that's how it started. And then on top of that, you were also looking at a very active site where there was a battle. It had seen the Civil War. So, on top of all that, you also had a cemetery right next door. And when John first started telling me about this mansion, he was reluctant to tell me where it was located, and I'll tell you why. It had changed owners over the number of years they tried to renovate it. The first time it was renovated, it was owned by two people. They were losing money right and left because the construction crew, the renovators, even though they were given double time or overtime, they would not stay. They would go in as a group in the morning, and then they would work as long as they were in the company of each other. But then once the sun started going down, they were technically fleeing. And then another group came in and the same thing happened. So Chris, it's like one of these things where what's making these people leave? And eventually the owners got fed up and they would sell it. So by the time I wrote the book, I even have a picture of the mansion.
When and how long did John and his crew of investigators start, and how long were they involved with investigations in that particular location?
I think they were there for over 6 months, which is kind of one of those things where, you have to bear in mind everybody was working full time. So what they were doing was trying to juggle their schedules so that they would be able to go as a group. Two people had quit the investigative group. They didn't work out for reasons other than that particular mansion. When the story opens, he was really short two people. and he was in the process of training another and looking for another. Because the mansion was so big, they had to bring in every equipment possible that they had. So between trying to recruit more people, trying to find time to be together, and then one of his colleagues who was already well-trained had to take on another case by himself, it stretched to 5 months or more. And they had to keep going back because there were just a lot of things that were happening that was going on that they never anticipated.
And not to give away too much, but the house itself actually led to them solving other older mysteries and different types of kind of unexplained events, right?
Yes, yes. It's interesting because the more they delved into the history of it, in the beginning they weren't going to, they were just trying to record EVPs, you know, electronic voice phenomena. They were just trying to use their cameras. They were trying to, they had the entire equipment. And at the end of the book, you'll see a whole entire list of equipment that they had used in the investigation. They had more equipment than they had people on site. He ended up having to enlist his wife to man the van. And she was kind of like the, you know, the monitor central. She was looking at multiple cameras from a remote location, which is right outside the mansion. And things were also happening to her as this was going on inside the house. There was one instance where she actually had never left the van, but they heard her voice talking to them and they thought they saw her inside the house, but she never actually left the van. There was just a lot of very disquieting, very eerie, very provocative types of beings that were in there. And I think a lot of them didn't want the investigators to record anything. They didn't want to leave. They wanted to be in the mansion. These are earthbound spirits that were somehow, they were stranded there forever, and they found it more comfortable to stay there and plagued the place. That's meanwhile, so John and his crew were, you know, they were being pressured by the owners because they were losing money every minute. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to ask you if it's possible that these earthbound spirits were stuck at this location because there of all the other traumatic energy that could have possibly occurred there.
I think so. And the interesting part is that later on they realized they were all in some way, shape, or form related. And there was a central figure, a central entity that caused them to be where they are. And that is probably the most terrifying of all the hauntings that were in there. There were some benign ghosts that were just basically stranded, probably not even realizing they had passed. And then there was one that was the one that I think was evil, even in life. Mm. And we started projecting, John and I, about what kind of evil it was that we were looking at based on his experiences and the collective experiences of the people that were around him, both the crew members he was asked to interview, as well as his own team members who experienced a lot of things. So I pieced it all together, and I, you know, if someone reads the book, they'll see that there's a flashback to certain happenings that happened in the past. Obviously, that's purely conjecture on my part and on his part, because we really can't put together who actually lived there, who actually stayed there at the time. There's very little evidence of that, unless you actually had remains. And there were remains in the basement.
Do you think that this house, or it's possible for some structures to actually take on a sort of personality or even a consciousness that makes that structure somewhat sentient in a way?
I don't know that I would use the word sentient, because there's, to me, there's the active haunting where there's an actual ghost that is attached to the dwelling. It creates disturbance. There's a suggestion here of a very active evil that's inside the house. That black smoke that's coming out of the stairwell up into the attic floor. But there's also the energies of the people who might have been involved. There was a huge fire in that house, and it was towards the back of the house, where the kitchen is located. And I think that there were probably people, victims, who were not able to get out as a result of that fire. So there might be an imprint of their energy, their angst, their sadness at having been killed, their lives being rudely interrupted. So you have that layering over an active infestation of something evil. And the people who were involved at the time of what this evil person had done. So you're seeing a child, you're seeing, at the opening scene, there's a dog or what appears to be a dog. And I'm not going to give away the ending as to what happened to them. But there's the imprint of the energy, and then there's the actual energy that's still present and stranded inside the site.
Now, of course, there's different understandings of what this negative energy or entities could be, and you believe that they're all earthbound spirits. Do you think that there is any non-human entities at play here?
It's interesting because I'm not going to profess to be a theologian or a demonologist, but John doesn't believe in He believes in evil, but he doesn't believe in the presence of a demon. A lot of times, people tend to attribute all kinds of negative hauntings to demonic energy. We don't really have evidence of that. What we do have evidence of is a lot of traumatic events that seem to center in this house. But there is an entity that I can't explain. And we kind of left it up in the air as to what it is. It is the one that's coming out of the cemetery next door. About 50 yards to the right of this house is a very old, broken down cemetery. It was walled in before, and at the time when they were investigating, the walls had crumbled so much that you could see from a distance it was in disuse. I think that one, probably that cemetery, has also seen a lot of tragedy, and I think there is something evil in the cemetery. I think that there was a human at the time who was a very evil person inside the mansion. Do they turn demonic? I don't know. I don't know what happens to people when they're that bad. It's kind of like, when you look at people through the centuries that are evil, like Hitler, what happens to them? Do they haunt the places where they had these, massacres and things?
Now, I want to get your thoughts on spirit attachments. We briefly kind of touched on this earlier, but in places like these with such a high concentration of even negative energy, would you think that there is a danger of bringing this to actually home with you and maybe infesting your own home?
And in this book, you'll see that a number of times. And it seems to happen when people, there is one instance where the gentleman walked in. He was one of the crew who was assigned to clean up the attic. And what he did was he went upstairs, cleaned up all kinds of messes. As you know, if you have a huge house with an attic, everything that you don't want is stored up there, or maybe you just figure I'll put it away until I need it. Well, he walked into this huge attic, which in itself was also infested. He started kind of coveting these objects, and a lot of them are antiques because they come from that period of time. He was very tempted, very tempted. And it came out that he ended up taking home one of those pieces of furniture. So it sounds familiar because I remember my previous book, Haunted Heirlooms, where people were either bringing in something into the antique store that they didn't realize had an attachment. This one is one of those things where there is an attachment to a piece of furniture. There's attachments to even stuff that's buried in the ground, as people will read on later on. And that was terrifying. I couldn't believe. He called me one night and said, "I forgot to tell you this. You got to sit down for this, Anna." And I said, "John, what are we missing here?" And I'm now in the process of writing the book. I'm halfway through. "I forgot to tell you this." And he would do that. He would call, and it was great because then it got to another conversation where I started thinking, okay, so this is something that happened before this happened. And then I started kind of like editing the book and adding that on. But one of those evenings is when he told me what happened to the gentleman who was the electrician on site. There was an electrician whose job was, so it's not just inside the house, if you notice, it's outside, it's at the cemetery. It's almost like this one area is just simply infested because there's so many things going on. So the electrician who worked by himself, his father was taken ill. It used to be him and his dad. He came out on a weekend. And of course, as things go, it's getting late, it's getting darker. He was digging. He was assigned to dig cable. And because the house is so old, they were still being lit by candles and gas and things like that. So he was trying to put electrical wiring into the house. Give you an idea how dark this house is. So as he was digging for, he was hoping there was no gas cable because it was very old, a very, very old neighborhood. He thought he hit a gas line. It was like a kind of like a yellow beige type of whatever it was that was in the soil. And as his shovel hit it, he instinctively jumped away because he figured whatever it is, it looks like it's cable. And in the back of his head, he was thinking, "I probably should take out insurance because if it is a gas line, boom. I would just go up in flames and so will the house," and you've seen it. But the house is way too old for that. It's not that advanced. So it wasn't. So then he started cleaning around it and discovered a bone. He discovered a bone in the ground, and it was the bone of a dog. It was a femur. The gentleman happened to be a breeder. He bred dogs. Actually, he took them from the breeder. He started training them. They were hunting dogs. So he then starts thinking this would go look really good in my basement, in my little man cave. Takes it out. He wraps it up, goes over to his truck, and just kind of tosses it to the side. And he continues digging. In comes John and his crew for another overnight. So he meets up with him on the road. Something had scared the guy off. And the guy thinks, "Okay, I'm going home. My shift is over. And I got a little souvenir, of a dog bone." He thought it was kind of strange because the bone was long and, all these things, but he figured, okay. Takes it home, and the rest is history. Talk about attachments. I won't give the rest away.
Yeah, that's incredible. So let's talk about the not only the attachments, but the dangers of our own either thought forms or negative energy or maybe substances, drugs, illicit substances that could have an effect on our environment if we are constantly coming into that environment with negativity and negative energy, that it could possibly manifest, like we were talking about, these negative spirits and energies, right?
Mm-hmm. And I think what happens is, you know, the previous conversation we have about, you know, people's states of mind, even as they're sleeping, it does have an effect, because these creatures, whatever they are, attach themselves. So if you're like to just think, if you're always happy, if you're always positive, you know, always optimistic, the lighter energies attach themselves to you. And then you feel well, you feel energetic and all that. This is the opposite. They keep walking back into it, and the workmen keep walking back. Their apprehensions are now getting higher and higher as people are quitting. Team members on the paranormal team, as they're experiencing things they can't record, they start to get really anxious about going back, because they're being driven to go ahead, complete the job you were hired to do, find out what this is about. Meanwhile, the construction crew is being driven, go ahead, do some overtime, get this done, we're losing money. Everybody is in a high anxiety, you know, negative state. So what happens? More things happen. They are dredging up whatever is in there. And you got to remember, Chris, even just the idea of moving the furniture from one room to the other, tearing up the walls, okay? Like in the first part of the book, this gentleman, he was pulling out the, what is it called? The sides of the wall. He was repainting it. He was taking out the wallpaper. And what does he dredge up? Just the pure act of that, even without the negative thought, the negative feeling, dredges up these things. Mm-hmm. But then you pair it with the people's fear, with their anxiety. That what you have is like a festival of all the negative things that are living there.
Yeah.
And it just goes crazy. It just goes totally crazy.
And you said this is kind of open-ended. This is still ongoing activity at this house, and there's really not a resolution for it, right?
No. And what they recommended was that the Historical Society get involved, because there were just so many historical stuff. All the hauntings seem to point to a much earlier century. The furniture that was in there, the bodies that were buried, they were all from an earlier century. And the feeling was to dig it up and modernize it was in effect desecrating it, because it was really a burial ground in a lot of ways. So they did not really want the current owner to make it into an inn. And the recommendation was to get clergy involved, if they were, to actually prevent people from taking things out of there or moving them. So in frustration, by the time I wrote the book, the owner left, sold it to someone else. And at this point, you know, we don't have permission to show the house. Mm-hmm. And actually, I had to move the location to somewhere else. The actual house is not in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
It could be anywhere.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Well, so what is what's next for you? Can you give us a little maybe sneak preview of what you'll be working on next?
Okay. I have quite a number of projects. One is involving a UFO investigator who has written a couple of books. We're hoping to collaborate on a couple of experiences he personally had as he was investigating these very strange occurrences that were happening to people around him. Mm. So I'm hoping to kind of develop that into another nonfiction book. So it's kind of like a little different from the books that I've done in the past, being that there's a co-author this time. But it's also more delving into ufology and what happens to an investigator. So this is in collaboration with a UFO investigator. He's had quite a number of years as an investigator and has written a number of books. So we're hoping to get together to talk about the unusual encounters that he personally has had. in addition to all the other accounts that were shared with him and how it impacted his personal life. Another one that I'm doing is actually a fiction novel. So I'm delving a little bit differently on a different avenue there. And this one is kind of like picking up on World War II. And it's a pretty good, interesting ghost story revolving around a German soldier who entered into these people's lives. It's set in Italy. And then I have a third one, but that's further afield. That's also with Beyond the Fray Publishing, and probably it will be looking at a release sometime September, October.
Wonderful. Anna Maria, thank you so much. This was fantastic. Where can the folks find all your work? I know you have a website and the books on Amazon.
Okay, so my website, you can actually click on the link, AnnaMariaManaloAuthor.com, and it'll take you directly to a description of each book. I've got four now, and then you can click on the link to get right into Amazon. A lot of times people just Google me and they'll find all kinds of links. But the best way to find me is probably Facebook or Instagram. And believe it or not, I'm not a fan of it, but I am on TikTok.
Right on. Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Anna Marie. This was fantastic. And we'll have you back on again to discuss the next one.
Okay, thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you. Until next time, everyone, have an excellent evening. We'll talk again tomorrow. See y'all.